From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Authorities have taken one person into custody today in connection with the suspicious packages sent to critics of President Trump. 12 packages have been discovered so far, the latest addressed to Senator Cory Booker and to the former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. NPR's Quill Lawrence has been following this story. Quill, what do we know about the man who was arrested earlier today?
His name is Cesar Sayoc, 56 years old. He's from Aventura, Florida, just north of Miami, possibly born in New York, but has lived in Florida for several years. He's a registered Republican. He has a criminal history in Florida dating back to 1991, including theft and fraud charges. What's perhaps most telling about him, if the media reports and the pictures we've been seeing of his van are in fact his, is just a political manifesto written on the side of his white van in stickers, where he has a lot of references to Vice President Pence and, of course, President Trump, and also against George Soros. Looking at his social media, you can see that he's very much involved in politics. He's tweeting about the governor's race against the Democratic candidate Andrew Gillum's down there.
Police were said to have known about this man. As you say, he had a criminal past. Do you know what it is that led authorities directly to him?
There had been some focus on Florida as where these packages had been mailed from very quickly. And experts have been talking about the amount of evidence that might have been left behind because these packages included tape and plastic bubble wrap, that there could be fingerprints as well as possibly DNA. So authorities were moving very quickly on this and were focusing on Florida. And we can assume that they tracked from possibly from surveillance cameras at the post office where they found that some of these packages might have been sent from. But it's early days.
Quill, do you have any idea just how he was arrested? Was he with the vehicle that that they took away at the time? Was he considered dangerous when they arrested him?
We know he was arrested at about 11 o'clock this morning in a parking lot of a shopping center in Plantation, Florida, which is just outside of Fort Lauderdale. There were some streets shut down around there, and there was this white van which was towed away, covered in stickers. People on social media have been tweeting pictures of that white van because it was such a noticeable vehicle. People who had seen it in traffic and taken pictures of it to send to their friends are now putting them up on social media, so you can kind of read into his character from what he displayed on his van.
President Trump got word earlier today, right after the arrest apparently, and spoke about the investigation and the arrest when the president was at an event for the Young Black Leadership Summit at the White House this afternoon. Here's a part of what he said.
We've carried out a far-reaching federal, state, and local investigation to find the person or persons responsible for these events. These terrorizing acts are despicable and have no place in our country.
The president also praised the speed with which law enforcement acted. What can you tell us, Quill, about the concentrated effort to make the arrest?
Well, you can see that after several years now with a terrorist threat front and center, the FBI and their joint terrorism task forces that they set up for him, for example, here in New York with the NYPD, they know what to do in these situations. And they managed to get a suspect in custody by the end of the week. The first of these suspect explosive devices was found at the estate of George Soros, the billionaire philanthropist, earlier this week. And between Monday and Friday, they have a suspect in custody.
And do we know if there are other suspects they're looking for?
We haven't heard that yet, but certainly this is an ongoing investigation,
which is basically a cover for we're still proceeding, or a cover for yes, we think there are others out there. Do you know?
I haven't gotten anything specific on that, but this is we've only identified the suspect within the hour, so it's early days yet. Certainly, they're warning people to be on the lookout for more possible suspicious packages, whether they'd be copycats or more that could have been sent by this same suspect. They're warning people to be on the lookout. And here in New York, they've encouraged people to call if they see anything suspicious and let the experts decide whether it was a silly reason to call or not.
NPR's Quill Lawrence. Thanks very much, Quill.
Thank you, Lisa.
Let's bring in Femi Okey, because on a story like this, no surprise, social media is responding. Femi, your host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Welcome back.
Thank you.
What are you seeing?
Well, when the story broke that the suspect was found, Twitter actually recorded how many people were tweeting about that news. There were 63,000 online at that particular moment. The best source of information right now, obviously your trusted news source, but they're also following at FBI. They have more than 2.3 million followers. People at the FBI and following the FBI are congratulating the FBI, congratulating the postal workers. And then in the broader world of Twitter, a couple of hashtags actually doing really well right now. One is hashtag MAGA bomber. And there are also conversations about the president's temperament, whether he has the right temperament to deal with a situation like this. Hashtag MAGA bomber is basically talking about how the suspect may or may not be aligned with the way President Trump is thinking. And then so many conspiracy theories. Let me give you just one. This is from Brian Horner. None of these so-called bombs, he says on Twitter, have gone off. They are not bombs. They are political packages that are being called bombs to distract voters, to trick them into voting Democratic. And so the conspiracy theories go on and on.
Right. You make an important point that this isn't just a story that's played out today on social media now that we have a suspect. It's been going on ever since the bombs started showing up in mailboxes. You mentioned people on the right saying these are false flags ahead of the elections, trying to make the Republicans look bad. The MAGA bomber reference you referred to as well. But have you noticed that conversation change at all now that we've seen images of this suspect's van? Appears to be very much a supporter of Donald Trump. Again, we don't know that much. It's early in this investigation and does also seem to have some issue with CNN, according to those stickers on the side of the van.
The conversation hasn't changed, and that's because the conversation tends not to change even when the facts are available right now. And that's particularly true of social media. So people who are saying this suspect is connected to the way Donald Trump is thinking, President Trump is thinking, have doubled down on that. The conspiracy theories are saying, no, this is a left-wing suspect who is just trying to make us Trump supporters look bad. You almost couldn't tell that there was more information that the FBI have found out if you looked on social media, except for I told you so.
Right. You're never going to solve that debate online.
Indeed.
For sure. Google, switching gears, announced yesterday that it has fired dozens of employees for sexual harassment over the past 2 years. Now, that came because of a story in the New York Times that said the company had dismissed Andy Rubin, a top executive at the company, for sexual misconduct, and that they paid him $90 million to go away. What's the response been online to that story?
Just astonishment that if this was the case, then the perpetrator would be paid to go away, and a lot of shock. Google responded in this way. Their CEO, Sundar Pichai, and their VP of People Operations, Eileen Norton, talked to the staff, and they said that they were very disturbed by the story that the New York Times ran. And then they tried to reassure the staff that they were working in a safe environment and free from sexual harassment. They didn't really address the payoff at all. And that's what made people on social media furious about this, particularly because of some of the very good work that Google has been doing. Recently, they did a layout all around the world of where Me Too was rising. And you could see the conversations about sexual harassment spreading across the world. It was a beautiful visualization of the current movement. And then even within their own organization, they have their own Me Too situation that they have to deal with. They are dealing with it, but it's the money that's leaving the company to pay the alleged sexual harassers. That is what social media is upset about.
As I said, $90 million. What I read was that he's getting something like $2 million a month, an incredible sum of money. But Andy Rubin was also the guy behind the Android phone, a very valuable commodity inside that company. On a lighter note, Femi,
yes.
Shall we talk about Cardi B?
Let's talk about Cardi B.
Let's listen.
Hello. My name is Cardi B, and I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. ASMR style.
Femi, where in the world have I been? What was that? ASMR style. Tell us what it is and how Twitter is. This was made for Twitter, by the way.
It's also made for radio, I have to say. So I've recently been working on a whole report about what ASMR is. Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. What does that mean? It is an impact that certain sounds have on your brain. Now, not the sort of sound of a chalk going down a blackboard that makes you go, ah, hate that sound. It's the sound that hits your brain that makes you feel, oh, that's so relaxing, that's so beautiful.
People use this to go to sleep.
They use it to go to sleep. They use it to distress themselves so that they can relax at the end of the day. And the sort of sounds that might trigger you, perhaps sponges in water, and you can hear the water trickling, perhaps paper being rustled as well. It is a theme and a genre that is doing really well online. Look out for it. Hashtag ASMR. Cardi B is a very well-known pop star if you like that kind of music. And she's also a fan of ASMR. You can have a relaxing weekend. Go online, find it, and see how it is. Whispering is also one of those triggers. Thank you so much.
Host of the stream on Al Jazeera. Thanks so much. A remote island in Hawaii is practically vanished. The small spit of sand known as East Island was critical habitat for endangered green sea turtles and monk seals. Today, it is mostly underwater. Hurricane Welaka tore through the central Pacific earlier this month and literally wiped East Island off the map. Satellite photos show only slivers of land where the 11-acre island once stood out from the ocean, and climate scientists say a warming ocean could be to blame. Chip Fletcher is a climate scientist at the University of Hawaii. He joins us now, and Chip, you were on East Island in July. When you heard that it had just been washed away, what was your reaction?
Well, it was quite stunning. I had not followed Hurricane Welaka. I knew it had headed north from us, but it never occurred to me that it might head into French Frigate Shoals and do damage to these very important small islands. So I was quite stunned.
Most people have probably never heard of this island. We're going to post before and after pictures at hereandnow.org, but tell us about it and why it was important to you.
Well, it's a beautiful place. My research team, which consists of undergraduate and graduate students and some postdoctoral researchers, headed up there in July under a grant with the National Fish and Wildlife Association. It is loose sand and gravel. It's made of the skeletal debris of the surrounding reef system. As small as it is absolutely critical to the Hawaiian green sea turtle and to monk seals. Mm. There is just not much land up there. This is low, so it's easy for them to haul out. There is a sort of upper region to the island where sea turtles could dig their nests and lay their eggs safely. And there are only about a half dozen of these that were left, but in the last month, we've lost two of them, one of them being this East Island, which was the largest one that remained.
What are the implications for those animals? Nearly half of the world's remaining green sea turtles nest there, and one-seventh of all the Hawaiian monk seals alive today were born on this little island. I mean, this was very important for those animals. Will they survive without it?
Yeah, yeah. The implications for these animals are they will have to find new habitat. And if you look at the photo that was taken this past weekend by government scientists who flew over the island, you can see a small little bit of sand still sticking up above the waves. And there must be a dozen monk seals already hauled out on that. So it points to the fact that this is really important land. They'll have to find a new place for raising their young, laying their eggs. And there are fewer and fewer of these places left. Will they turn to the south and come to the main Hawaiian Islands? That can be problematic because much of the dune area in the main islands has been developed with roads and houses. Can they turn to the north to some of the other atolls? There are some additional sandy islands to the north, but not very many.
Huh. You knew this island was low-lying. It was sandy, loose sand. Did you expect it to vanish one day, or were you surprised that the hurricane did this much damage?
Well, the answer is yes to both of those. I figured that this island, under the threat of sea level rise, maybe had another decade or two or three, but certainly by mid-century, I would be surprised if it were still in existence. I didn't expect with a location this far north that it stood a very strong chance of being intersected by a hurricane. But of course, with climate change, These weather systems are finding new pathways. They are migrating away from the equator, and there are new areas, new habitats, and new human communities that are being threatened by hurricanes that hadn't happened before.
The 2018 hurricane season we're seeing actually is one of the most intense on record in the Pacific. Are there other islands around there that are also in danger, or are there other problems that you foresee happening because of that?
Yes, it was and still is a very intense hurricane season. And I think earlier this week, we saw a hurricane strike the Northern Marianas Islands. At one point, the wind gusts approached 200 miles per hour. The average wind speed was up around 165 miles an hour. And, you know, this is an example of what a Category 6 hurricane would look like, even though we have no such category. Since last year's hurricane season in 2017, scientists are now thinking with the growth in hurricanes, they're getting larger, the wind speed stronger, maybe it's time for a new category.
Is there a chance that East Island could come back someday?
There is a chance. We're sort of crossing our fingers. It looks as if the sand was moved by the hurricane to the north and northeast. The trade wind waves may push that sand back towards where it originally was, and we might see some accretion or building of the island. But our understanding of these islands is that they formed on a falling sea level around 2,000 years ago. We are currently in a stage of rising sea level, and so the fundamental background conditions for reforming this island don't exist.
That's Chip Fletcher, a climate scientist at the University of Hawaii. Thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Another conversation now with connections to climate, this one pertaining to the economy. The U.S. economy grew at 3.5% in the third quarter of this year, according to government figures out today. One of the few things that Democrats and Republicans seem to agree on is that economic growth is good for everybody. But our next guest argues that prizing economic growth has, quote, driven us into a ditch from an environmental standpoint. Ajay Singh Chowdhury is the executive director of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. He says if we want to deal with climate change, small incremental change won't work. He says we need to rethink our system of capitalism, starting with our obsession with economic growth, because the focus on growth causes us to prioritize the wrong things.
There are lots of things that in the short term could mean certain kinds of economic growth. There's a lot more money, right? There's a lot more net GDP to be made in extractivism than there is in sort of sustainability. So actually what we need to really think, be sort of shifting the conversation from, and this is a huge shift. It's not just a shift about policies. It's a shift about the way we imagine politics, the way we imagine economics, is not so much do we want growth? Do we want less growth? It's what do we actually want from growth? Usually when people say, oh, I want high growth rates, what they mean is something like, oh, high growth rates are going to lead to more prosperity. But I actually know I can do a nice pair comparison, right? We have very high growth rates in China. We have very high growth rates in India. And yet somehow China seems to be able to turn those into slightly better social outcomes than India is. A lot of what we associate with growth can be achieved through other means, distributional means, other ways of thinking about economic outcomes than what we currently talk about.
Is this an academic exercise, or do you really think this could happen?
It is possible. Do I think it's like 100% like it's a certainty? No. In fact, there's like so much arrayed against it. I think so often this conversation about climate change gets framed in these like hilarious things like, oh, are you like how much plastics are you recycling? How much are you composting? Have you eaten more beans than meat? Right? Like as opposed to like how have you worked to make an actual democratic politics more possible today, right? Have you become part of a movement? Are you doing those things? Those things are actually much more important, believe it or not, than our individual consumption choices.
What kind of movement? I mean, like one – give me one thing. Okay, so I could decide I'm not going to eat red meat anymore. But you're saying instead of that, you become part of a movement that would do what?
Anyone who is emphasizing any movement that is trying to move the needle to give more power to popular sovereignty and less to capital, less to the sovereignty of concentrated wealth and money, is going to not necessarily cause all the changes that I am saying, but it is necessary.
But what kind of movement? Give us an example.
You can think of two sort of tendencies. One is the sort of rise of a sort of reinvigorated left, whether you associate that with the Democratic Socialists of America or other movements. That is a very important part of the conversation. Another would be very local organizations, but with a sort of very grand vision. This would be groups like Cooperation Jackson in Mississippi, who are really trying to build a sort of eco-sustainable society from the ground up.
Meaning what?
Oh, meaning that they are working, you know, both to set up a sort of a system of greater democratic governance. They are trying to – and they are succeeding in some ways to build a sort of eco-sustainable city from the ground up, including agriculture, including manufacturing. But that doesn't ignore these political and economic parts of the story, right, that are trying to put really a democratic control as the necessary medium through which this management is possible. So that's a very local response. There are national responses. There are even international stories. I mean, we have built a global system, and part of the story of climate change is a story of building a global system of sort of almost absolute freedom for capital and really limited freedom for people. And in some ways, that's what's got to be reversed. We need more time, more freedom. I call this temporal freedom for people, free movement for people, and greater restriction and democratic control on capital.
That's Ajay Singh Chowdhury, Executive Director of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, sharing his views on some of the larger shifts that he'd like to see to our economic system if we're going to combat climate change.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
There's new evidence of a strong economy today, with the Commerce Department reporting growth of 3.5%. Between July and September, the economy is on track to have its best year since 2005. But one sector not doing so well, housing, especially in the Northeast, where it's estimated home sales are down by 50% from last year. And some economists are saying Trump's tax cuts are to blame. Mike Regan is senior news editor at Bloomberg. Mike, it's good to have you.
Oh, good to be here, Peter.
So this 50% drop in sales in the Northeast, it is the midpoint of a broader estimate. But either way, it is large and it's sudden. So what's going on?
Well, before we even talk about the implications of the tax cuts, it's important to realize the background here about the housing industry nationally. There has been this concern coming into this year even that home prices had just gotten too high for many members, especially of the big demographic of millennials, to afford. And then you tack onto that this aggressive rise in interest rates that we've seen. And that makes buying a home even more expensive. But finally, it's clear that many believe the tax cut is also having an effect here. Many critics of this year's tax cut had warned in advance that there could be this sort of impact on housing on the coasts, especially because the tax plan capped the state and local tax deductions that you can claim on your federal income taxes. So if you get less of a tax refund for your local real estate taxes, and new homes tend to have the highest real estate taxes of any homes, it obviously makes buying a new home even more expensive. And that means people that are upgrading from older homes are sort of priced out too. So it has a very much a ripple effect.
Let's take a look at some of those numbers. A 30-year mortgage on a $400,000 house in Providence, Rhode Island, now $21,000 more expensive. And that's not even a very expensive city in relative terms. In Boston, $84,000 higher. That makes a big difference.
It does. It does. And like you said at the beginning, the economy is strong. Unemployment is historically low. the demand for houses should be there. It's just that all of these issues make homes more expensive. And builders of new homes are, for obvious reasons, going to be reluctant to cut prices too aggressively.
We did see these solid GDP numbers today. Unemployment is still very low. What does this housing news say about the broader economy? Should we be concerned that things are starting to tip the wrong direction?
It's definitely something to keep an eye on. One thing I've been looking at very closely is the share prices of publicly traded home builders. There's an index of home builder stocks that's absolutely crashed this year. It's down 40%.
Wow.
So that signals to me that people believe these builders are going to have to lower prices pretty aggressively, really killing their profit margins. And home building and housing is such an important element of the economy. I don't need to remind anyone of its role in the financial crisis. So this is certainly something that all of Wall Street, I can guarantee you, is keeping a very close eye on.
The average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is about a percentage point higher today than it was a year ago. That's going to make people's monthly payments quite a bit more expensive as well. So thanks for watching this for us. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News.
Thanks, Peter.
Composer and guitarist Bill Frisell is a singular talent who's all about collaboration. This weekend, he's playing with the Ron Miles Circuit Rider Trio on the West Coast. Bill Frisell has worked with the L.A. Philharmonic, Elvis Costello, Paul Simon, and many others. But on his latest album called Music Is, Bill Frisell goes it alone. He plays every instrument. The album's a blend of earlier works and new compositions. One of the new pieces is called Change in the Air. Music is a riff on the phrase music is good, which is a motto of Bill Frisell's. The album hit the top of the charts earlier this year. We spoke with Bill Frisell about the album this spring. He's appeared on more than 200 albums, more than 40 as a band leader, so why go solo this time around?
Well, that's been a challenge for me to play alone. From the first moment I picked up a guitar, there was this social aspect with, you know, I've always been a shy person and awkward, but with the guitar, it was like this magic wand that seemed to bring everyone together. And so all along, the guitar has been about interacting with other people. It's never been, I know there's, you know, there's this, the tradition or whatever with a, especially with a singer-songwriter, the lone troubadour or whatever, you know, but it's something that sort of hanging out there in front of me that I'm just trying to get it together to be able to do that. You know, like when I was in school, I had to take a speech class. That, like, talk about a nightmare situation.
If you could only have had an instrument with you.
Yeah. I mean,
to do the talking.
As long as I've got that in my hands, then everything is cool.
So then why another solo album? I mean, were you trying to kind of force yourself into your peak discomfort level?
I don't want to make it sound like that either. It's because over the years, it's become just another aspect of what I do. I mean, the first time I tried to do a solo concert was in the early 80s. I tried to play something alone, and it was really just so uncomfortable and it was a drag, and I swore I'd never do it again, but then I thought, no, I got to get this together. So a year later, I tried it again, and then it kept getting better, and after a certain point, it was like, wow, I can actually do this, and it started to feel like music.
Well, this seems like a right time to talk about Thankful. So on a song like this, what comes first, the notes, or it sounds backwards, the inspiration for the notes, because you say it's a tribute to the musicians that you've played with and your wife and your daughter too?
Usually it's just a melody, just a very simple, you know, I'm saying I'm writing it, but then Like one thing that happened on this album, there's this song that begins and ends, I think I call it Pretty Stars, and then Made to Shine at the end. That was something I quote-unquote wrote.
These are the songs that bookend the album, Pretty Stars and then Made to Shine at the end.
When I wrote it, I recognized that it was a very, very common chord sequence. Prior to the recording of this album, I was playing at this club called The Stone in New York, and I was playing some of the music that I would record. And so I played that song, and a guy at the club one night, he said, "Oh, I love, that was a really great version of Jesse James." And I thought, "What? What are you talking about? I don't know any song called Jesse James." And he played me this recording, and I was like, "Oh my God, that's the same, it's almost the exact same melody." And then I checked it out, and it was like, you know, it's just an old traditional song. Like, I probably heard the Kingston Trio play it when I was 5 years old or something.
Oh, sounds like a lawsuit in the making.
Yeah, and I could be in trouble now. But I think it's a, you know, it's like a public domain kind of a thing. And then there's so much music floating around. I don't know where it comes from, whether I'm writing it or am I remembering it or what is it?
I'd love it if you talk about track four, which is What Do You Want? Let's listen to some of it.
Okay. Yeah, what you're hearing right now is just one chord that I played on the guitar that was captured, frozen, and sustained, and then that went through some other processing. So there's sort of a drone, one sound that was originally from the guitar, and then that's going through like a vibrato pedal. I think that's all it really, it's kind of a that shaking sound. And then I'm using that as the backdrop for just this one solo clean guitar sound. I was trying to stay in this state of not being sure what was going to happen.
You mean as you're playing it or composing?
Yeah. Well, the composing is, you know, I'll have these melodies or pieces. They never feel like they're finished anyway. But what I did to prepare for the album was I actually played 6 nights at the Stone in New York. Every night I brought in a pile of music and I tried to play things that I wasn't familiar with, either old compositions of mine or new ones. And I tried to keep myself just off balance for that whole week. And that's what I wanted to continue on into the studio. I didn't want to have it all figured out, like mapped out what was going to happen. I didn't know what instrument I was going to play. I didn't really know anything when I went in there.
You know, for somebody who, it sounds like you would, in your younger days, hide behind your instrument, that takes a lot of confidence to now go in and not know where you're going to end up and put yourself in a strange or unusual or difficult, uncomfortable place intentionally.
Well, but that's when the stuff really happens. I mean, that's the thing about music. It's like when you're dreaming and you jump off a cliff and you just start flying. And that's the best feeling with music for me, is when you can take these chances. But I say jumping off a cliff, but like, what's going to happen if you play a wrong note? Well, okay. You know, you get all the thrill, but you don't get banged up too much.
What song would you like us to go out on here?
There's that one, Monica Jane, which I wrote for my daughter. First time I recorded that song was, it was just about a month after she was born. It was my first trip being away from her. I went to Oslo to record with Paul Blay and Paul Motion and John Sermon, and I had this song but no title, and we played the song and Paul Motion said, "It sounds like your daughter, you know, you should name that after." So that's where that song came from, 32 years ago now, more.
Bill Frisell, thank you so much. The album is beautiful. It's called Music Is. Really nice to talk to you.
Oh, you too. Thanks so much for listening and checking out the music. I really appreciate that.
Bill Frisell in our conversation from the spring. He's on tour with his newest album, Music Is.
President Trump is heading to Southern Illinois tomorrow. He'll be holding a rally for Republican incumbent Congressman Mike Bost, who represents the 12th District of Illinois. Bost is facing a challenge from the Democrat, Brendan Kelly, who is also the St. Clair County State's Attorney. And that's where we're going to be going for this week's District Profile. WSIU News Director Jennifer Fuller joins us now from Carbondale, Illinois. Jennifer, welcome.
Thanks, Peter.
You're right there in coal country, a district that went for President Trump by a pretty good margin in 2016. Tell us more about this district.
That's absolutely right. Now, if you look at the national polling, what they would tell you is that the 12th Congressional District in Illinois leans Republican. And that is in part because up until about 4 years ago, this district was held by a Democrat, Jerry Costello, for decades. It was kind of a big surprise in 2014 when the district flipped Republican, when Mike Bost won his first election to federal office. Now, as you look at the polling, still a fairly red district, but this 12th congressional district race is still very, very close.
The issue of steel and manufacturing jobs has been important in the past, and that's one of the things that came up during Tuesday's debate between these two candidates. Here's the Republican Mike Bost.
Just this year, we brought 800 steel jobs back to Granite City, completed overhauling the VA appeals process to help our veterans, and made our schools safer from violence.
Jennifer, he mentioned steel jobs there. U.S. Steel decided to reopen a plant in your area last spring after President Trump announced those tariffs on imported steel. That's got to be an important and compelling argument for the Republican.
Sure, absolutely. And that's in the northern part of this district, which stretches roughly from just east of St. Louis on the Mississippi River and then stays on the west side of southern Illinois all the way down to the tip of the state. So in the northern part of this district, those steel jobs are critical. And they were losing jobs, hundreds at a time. And it was in part because of this trade issue that Congressman Bost believes that President Trump made the right choice in the tariffs. This is also a very agricultural district, though, too. So there are farmers that were quick to say, wait, what about us? These trade tariffs really hurt us. Hmm. And so some of the help there that was provided is helping ease that pain. But there's still quite a bit of uncertainty about what the economy will do in this area.
Are those economic issues what drove the district from being traditionally Democratic to tilt toward the Republican?
I think it was partly economy, but it was partly social. The Democrats in southern Illinois are your typical southern Democrats. They're very socially conservative. The Democrats in this area are pro-Second Amendment. They're anti-abortion. They look a little bit more socially like a Republican, but they tend to be a little bit more fiscally more liberal.
Okay, let's talk about the Democrat in this race, Brendan Kelly. He's a Navy veteran, and in that debate on Tuesday, he said that he hears a lot from voters that the strong economy and the strong stock market that we have been seeing up until just the last couple weeks or so is not trickling down to them.
They see the cost of their prescriptions going up. They see the cost of getting an education going up. But what's not going up here in Southern Illinois are people's wages. This is one of the worst places for wage growth in the entire United States.
What more can you tell us about how Brendan Kelly is positioning himself for this election?
Well, his message throughout the campaign has been that Congressman Bost has not been listening to his constituents. Anytime you talk with Mr. Kelly, he talks about specific people that he has met while he's out on the campaign trail and the difficulties that they're having, whether it's grandparents, raising grandchildren because the parents in that picture are affected by the opioid crisis, or perhaps people who had a union job but left that union job because the wages just aren't going up. If you look at the 12th Congressional District, although the unemployment rates are getting better, the highest unemployment rates in the state of Illinois are inside the 12th Congressional District.
You mentioned unions. We should note this. The United Steelworkers Union is backing Kelly. So it's not that all steel votes are going to go for the Republican.
That's true. And at the same time, the Illinois Education Association is backing Bost. So those votes that you would traditionally count on that come from union organized people may not fall in the traditional categories.
Now, we're taking a look at the polls. Bost, it looks like he's starting to pull away, but President Trump is coming to stump for him tomorrow. I guess a sign that this race is not yet settled. What do you think it's going to come down to in the end?
It really comes down to who comes out to vote. The St. Clair County, the Metro East area, which is that area just east of St. Louis, East St. Louis, Belleville, those sorts of areas, has traditionally been very Democratic. Lots of votes coming out for Democratic candidates there. The rest of the district a little bit more red. So it's all going to depend on who comes to the polls and in what kind of numbers. Mr. Kelly's campaign, for example, during the presidential rally tomorrow, is organizing people to knock on doors and try and get those supporters ready for the November election.
All right, a snapshot of Illinois' 12th district with WSIU News Director Jennifer Fuller. Thanks very much. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.